What's up, Kyle?
How's it going? Thanks for having me again.
No, thanks for coming back. I know it's been a few years. Like we're at 600 shows. You're 232.
So yeah, I was here. I think April 2022.
Been a while.
Yeah,
been a while. Things have changed a little bit since the industry. That would have been the high, right? That would have been the
midpoint? Probably close to peak.
Yeah.
Peak COVID.
And I think that are the younger generation having a hard time understanding that this is not the, well, that was not the norm. This is the norm.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying for a while now. And I know you've been saying it as well, that a few years ago, just things weren't, it wasn't reality. Like now we're in reality. Now we're at what normal is with interest rates. Interest rates are normal. Historically,
we never had it so good, so low.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just when they're almost at zero, it's everybody's just taking out money and building, and now the money has sort of dried up. But these are just normal times.
I kind of wish, I don't know of anybody that's really educating. I'm not just talking about construction in general, but just, I go back to the educational process of educating people. Can we go back to the mindset of you buy something when you have the money, not when you have the credit?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that doesn't exist anymore, to buy something when you have the money. A lot of people, and it's unfortunate because you get, I've even seen renovation companies pop up where they have the lawn signs and they're like, pay $50 a week for your rental. You know, so they're obviously financing this stuff, right? So like they're trying to get more clientele.
I don't think they're actually financing it themselves. There's actually third party companies
that's what they're doing. Financing. Yeah, they're bringing them in, but they're offering that, get this rental now and we'll do a credit. But as a business owner, you still have to pay your payroll. So you're still paying them in full for doing the work.
I remember we looked into the financing a couple of years ago for these companies that offer it for our clients, and the payment terms were ridiculous. Like they wouldn't give us a deposit. And I think 70% of the payment was once we're done the job. Like,
it's too risk. It's
not going to work.
No, it's way too much risk, right?
Yeah, for sure.
How's everything? Well, let me first share these. So 2x2 Construction, Kyle Springer's here, 647-425-0292. You can find them all over IG under 2x2 Construction, the numbers and the X. And then website, www or no?
Yeah, just 2x2construction.ca.
Okay. And then I'm... Quick shout out to Brian. I'm wearing his Target contracting. I haven't spoken to Brian in a bit. I think he's been busy. He's been trying to build his own little self-contained kind of units on his property. He's a little bit northeast of the city, and he's bought some land, and he's trying to, and last time he was on the show, he was having a little brief conversation about fighting the government on trying to get approvals for these units because they wanted him to treat them as if they're self-contained dwellings, which is not the idea of what he was trying to build. He was just trying to build some small bunkies on his land for people to come, enjoy Mother Nature kind of thing, and just, you know, like, take a look at this and just kind of a step up from tent. You know what I mean? It's basically right. What he was trying to build, but the city wouldn't give him the approval. So I don't know if that battle is going on or if it's over or whatever, but I'm wearing his tee today, which is great. But I want to get, talking to you, it's always great. I mean, I'm respectful of what you've built so far. And for such a young person, you've got such an old person's mentality. You know what I mean? You probably have paid attention to a lot of people ahead of you and realize these are better ways of doing this. You know what I mean? Instead of doing what the herd is doing, right? Which is really, I'm seeing it in a massive rash right now. I'm seeing a lot of young people making a lot of mistakes in the construction industry now. When I look at it from afar, these mistakes are going to make these people leave the industry. And then now I started looking at things where, like I was mentioning to you off mic, I get approached by a lot of young tradespeople just getting started out. They got their education. They did the pre-apprentice. They did a bunch of stuff to get all their ducks in a row. And now they're looking for work. And we're not hiring you right now. We can't hire you right now. And that's the problem. So then basically, what do you think is going to happen to this young generation? I think they're going to leave. They're going to have to find some sort of employment somewhere and get some money coming in, but it ain't going to be the construction industry.
I think a lot of people, especially in construction, think more short term. I'm trying to think decades out, 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. I still want to be working in this industry and in business in general until my 80s.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like I would get bored in retirement. So that's why I'm thinking more long-term and trying to make more long-term decisions instead of short-term. Sort of going to what you were saying about like saving up the money before you actually buy something. We focus mostly on construction management, and we don't even have a company vehicle, and we're doing like a dozen projects at the same time.
Company vehicles, pure ego. Like
sometimes, it depends. Sometimes you need it, but I've seen companies that are just a few years old, and they've got like a dozen brand new trucks that are fully wrapped. It's like, how are you affording this?
Obviously, that money is coming from the pricing of the jobs that you're doing, and obviously it's coming out of the profit margin that you're acquiring, but is it necessary to do that? I don't think it is. I don't, like, I remember when we last spoke, you talked about how you were driving a much older vehicle, a sedan, a car, and not have that mindset of having a truck, not having a fleet, not having any of that stuff, because you were like, that's not what's really moving my company forward.
Yeah, like I just drive a 2021 Honda Civic and I can get a dozen 2x4s in there.
You could be very resourceful.
If I really need to, but
the seats go down.
Yeah. And, but I try to avoid doing stuff like that. And it's just about proper preparation using delivery companies like Toolbox and Bebo. And Renault Run went bankrupt, I think it was last year. Yeah. They were just growing way too fast. And that's what happens. If you try to grow too fast, you're going to be like a company like Renault Run, where you're getting in all this money and spending and spending and spending. And then you just become illiquid because you just didn't have a proper grasp on your finances.
So what's the first thing that you would tell a young tradesperson coming into the industry? Is not look at having all these upfront expenses or these monthly bills. Because when you start carrying this float, what I noticed when I started talking to a lot of the other companies that were expanding in the peak in 2021, 2022, when everything was really good, they started expanding. They were getting these offices, these shops, vehicles, sign, all kinds of stuff, right? Doing all kinds of promotion here and there. They're promoting hockey teams, golf clubs, all this other stuff, right? But now what's happening is that they're trying to pool their resources together just to keep their monthly expenses up. And I'm like, so you're basically just surviving at this point. So I agree with you that you get the young people coming in, they want to look like hotshots, so they want to get all these things. But that's a bad move. Yeah,
if you're trying to be a subcontractor, drywaller, framer, electrician, plumber, it is so easy for you to get business, especially when you first start. All you have to do is go on Google, make a list of 100 builders, call them, and then just figure for every 100 calls you make, you'll probably land one of those builders as a client. So if you have that mindset and just hustling when you start, you don't need to advertise, especially if you're a sub trade, because essentially who are the gatekeepers to your work? That's the builders. Yeah. So if you develop those relationships with the builders, they're going to give you consistent business. At the same time, if you keep outreaching to other builders, it's just so easy to get the business.
What do you say to the kids that are saying they're already using somebody that's my trade? How am I supposed to get in there if they're using somebody that's already my trade, right?
Well, then you just call other builders, because you're going to get, and you can also follow up with them in the future, because you're going to catch a builder at the right time. Like, yep, we've been using some trades since we started 5 years ago, 2x2. Like, for example, our drywaller, Rob. We use Rob for almost all of our projects. I know you've used him before. He's been on the
Rizzotti?
Show. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, we've been using him since 2019, since our first drywall job. There's been a couple times where we've used other drywallers, depending on scheduling and timing and costing. But
he was always your first call.
He was always, yeah, first call.
But that's the thing about it, is that you can't be deterred by builders saying, I already got a guy. I mean, I've used the same guy several times until that person either scheduled or made a mistake and didn't want to own up to it. So all of a sudden, I'm like, here's an opportunity. Now you want to come in, give it a try, and I'll give you a try. And that's how you start building relationships.
Yeah, for me as a builder, if you make my job easy on the site, I'll make your job easy and your business easy, where I can just give you almost all of my work.
Yeah.
If you make my life easy.
And you do that for every trade.
I try to, but there are some trades that just don't understand the game of business and relationships. When I first started in this industry, or in business for myself, it's been about 10 years now.
Yeah.
My dad would always tell me, what business are you in? And I would keep saying construction. And then he's like, no, you're in the people business. And then people. I didn't really fully grasp it until years later that this is a business based on people and relationships.
Twofold, the crew building and the client purchasing. Like, you got to understand that.
Yeah, so there's like trades like drywall where we've had good success over the last 5 years where we've mostly used one drywall company. But then there's trades like framers. We've used, I think, 6 or 7 different framers over the last few years.
What's the reasoning why you've had so many more framers than drywallers?
Well, coming from a framing background, I sort of understand on the framing side that a lot of these guys, they're just not very good with dealing with people, and their emotions flare up when things are stressful. They're working in tough conditions, in the cold, they're working in the heat.
Heat, yeah.
So then emotions start to come involved, and sometimes they lash out. And sometimes you just have to just accept it, let them cool down, and then just have a conversation with them when they cool down. But sometimes they just don't get it. And that's going to be the first and last job.
I've seen, I would say, out of all the trades, the framing trade is probably the one that has possibly the most turnover. Because, and what I mean by that is that you'll get someone who's young, wants to change the mindset of what that particular trade is all about, because the one that they're replacing had this ego grow too much, and they grew their business too big, and they had too many people on staff, too many trucks, too many whatever, right? And they just kept on doing that because they thought that was a sign of growth. So here comes a young hotshot coming in, scaled down, working just as good, not all that overhead, and then proving that they can do a good job. They get an opportunity to get a job, then they do it. They do a good job, and all of a sudden they're happy. Then they get another job. And then what I see, like clockwork, that same young framing crew becomes that older Eagle crew. You see it, right?
Yeah.
I see it so many times, man. And I'm like, what is it about this framing part? I don't know what it is, like, unless they just think that, oh, you know, we make everything come to shape. You know what I mean? We're the first crew on the site that basically puts an outline on the project. I get it, but you guys can also do that without the ego and do that without all the overhead. Like, I mean, I was just talking to Tim from Pound for Pound out west there, and he's downsized because of the economy, right? So it's like he's, you know, two guys had to go because they couldn't survive in the scarcity of work that he had going at that particular time, and they had to find something. So he's still managing. He's managing with his much smaller crew. And I think that the framers that know how to handle things with just like three people do far better than the ones that have this ego. I need to grow and grow and grow and grow.
Well, that's a couple of things I've realized with framers in general, is that I haven't seen really any framing company that has expanded more than a couple crews. And from my experience, expanding to the couple crews, it's tough. Unless you have like a very, very good lead on site, then either you're managing the two crews where you're making less money.
Yep.
The only way you can get that money back is by bringing in a third crew because you're focusing more on management, or you have to physically work in one of the crews yourself as a lead. Which it's a tough balance. It's for any business. Like when you start out, you're just stuck wearing all the hats until you can save up enough money to hire people to fill those roles or those other hats. But when you're first starting, you're gonna, like, you want all those flashy objects, like the new tools, like the truck. And that's where a lot of people falter. Like myself, when I first started, I got a brand new truck. And then after 2 years, it was a lease. And then I was stuck with $30,000 that I had to either buy out the truck or return it. But the truck had a bunch of damage and I couldn't really return it. So I just had to buy it out and just work to pay it off.
They didn't have the cushion? Or is that just only allowed on personal vehicles, not truck vehicles?
I got the warranty where it's like for any scratches or dents.
Yeah, but there's like a cap on it. Like,
yeah, it's like amount. A dent that's like bigger than a nickel you have to pay for.
I remember when ridiculous. I got, what was it I got? I can't remember what vehicle I got. I remember the sales guy trying to sell me the pitch, and he was like, you can bring this car back with the door ripped off and we'll still accept it at the end of the lease. And I was like, don't tempt me, man. Like, I will actually do that. I'll rip that door off and bring it back to you because I don't want the vehicle at the end of it. I'm not buying it out, right? But I never did. I had enough and then it's gone like that. I wanted to ask you, Kyle, do you think money-wise, let's go back to the framing crew. If you've got one crew, you're doing really well. You've got a builder. Builder's keeping you busy. Maybe you got two builders and they're keeping you busy. So you're hopscotching the projects, right? Do you think getting that second crew is about making more money? Because I don't think you make more money by getting that second crew.
You don't. I think you're only going to start making more money once you get into crew three and four. The second crew is when you actually probably take a loss in income, unless you're physically leading one of the crews and working full time and then spending your nights and evenings or early mornings doing all of the back end, the paperwork or whatever you have to do as for a business owner. But then if you have a problem on your other site and you're working in the one crew, it's like now you got to go deal with that. And now you're stuck with the guys that are inexperienced on this site.
And then you're trying to get to a third crew because that's where you can start making money. But you can't get to that point just yet. To get a third crew, now you got to get, what, like three or four builders on your side that are you're the first phone call.
Yeah.
Which is challenging to do.
The hardest part of business, which I've come to realize, is not finding the clients. It's finding the talent and retaining the talent.
Keeping it.
Yeah.
100%.
Because like you said, there's a lot of turnover in this industry and framing specifically.
But today, is the talent understanding what they were billing in 21 and 22 and part of 23 isn't the same number today?
I don't think people have fully got there to realize that. I think it just comes down to what their expenses are and the cost of living. And this is what they have to make.
Yeah.
So they're just going to keep searching and searching and searching until they find someone who's desperate enough to pay them that inflated wage because they have no other choice.
But you as a business owner and you got a client, you're submitting your numbers. You have a rough idea of what the medium would be on that hourly rate or that scale for that particular trade. So you're submitting numbers to a client that way. And now you can't find somebody that's of that parameter. And now you're left in a pickle at that point. You can't really hire the person who's charging more because now it's taking money out of your pocket.
Yeah. Or you have to hire someone that's more green or fresh and you just have to train them. But again, that takes your time as a business owner.
Your time as a business owner, right? So these days, you're not on the tools anymore. You're done. You're managing now, basically. You're managing crews.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have any in-house workers. So even for labor and handyman, we use company U-Build. You had Matt on the show, I believe. Okay. And we use his company for anytime we need handyman or labor work. That's how we can subcontract everything. Like, I still keep some tools in my car. Sometimes you're at a job site and the fence blows down and you have to resecure it. Take some like tie wire or just board up a window because framing is done and it's raining and you're doing mechanicals.
Yep.
Sometimes you don't have a choice. You have to do those small little tasks. And that's why I still keep some tools in the car. But trying to move away from that and focus more on the office. Luckily, I have a team in the office supporting me. But I'm trying to spend my time more 3 days in the office, 2 days on the site. We had a site manager start earlier this year from January. He left in around June because he wanted more money. So he found another position.
So he's there for less than 6 months?
Less than 6 months.
He was doing a good job?
He was doing an okay job. I don't think was worth more than what we were paying him.
Okay.
And so his new employer, he actually applied there 6 months ago. And the employer at the time said, well, you don't have enough experience. So now 6 months later, the employer apparently reaches back out and says, hey, we've reconsidered and we want to hire you.
At the higher wage.
At the higher wage, yeah. So I told him, I'm like, you realize what they're doing. They're just hiring you because they have too much work. And then once they don't need you and they find someone else,
they're going to
let you go.
Yeah, of course.
And on top of that, the other red flag that I pointed out that he obviously ignored is he only gave us 2 days notice because the
2 days notice that he's leaving you guys?
Yeah.
That's such a nice, smart move.
Exactly. And because his employer said, or the new employer said, either you start Monday or we're revoking the offer. And
see, that's a bad move on their part.
But it's also like, you should see the red flag.
Yeah.
If they're going to do that to you, like right at the beginning, what are they going to do to you when you're working with that employer? Like a company like that, you're just a number to them.
Yep. They're going to replace them. It's guaranteed.
For sure.
Whether it's in 6 months or a year from now, they're going to replace them. Somebody else is going to come along. Young guy?
He's in his, I think, late 30s.
Okay. All right. And he doesn't get this yet? Or is he just new to the industry?
He's been in the industry for probably a decade.
Huh. But that's the generation. They'll go wherever the dollar goes, which is really stupid when you should really go where the relationship goes. Like, I still stay in touch with every person that has worked with me, and we have been on good terms, or we left on good terms, whether they worked for me for a period of time as an employee or as a sub or whatever, and then they wanted to go someplace else and work someplace else. I had no ill feelings or anything like that. I still speak to them. I still have their phone numbers in my phone, and they still reach out and they'll text me and they'll talk. You got 10 seconds, Manny, to talk? Sure. But the ones that burn, the ones that would tell me I'm out of here in 2 days, then I have no time for you.
It's definitely don't burn any bridges. When I was working for people, I tried to always leave things on good terms. If they decided they don't want to keep things on good terms, that's up to them. Even with sub trades that we use now, even if we're not going to use them again, I try to keep things on good terms because it's a big industry, but at the same time, it's a small industry. A lot of people know each other and people talk. So you have to also do reputation management and just can't be a dick as much as you want to. You just can't.
What's your focus, Kyle, in the office there for the 3 days? What do you want to achieve in those 3 days when you're in the office?
It's more so giving support to the site supers on site, as well as focusing on other business aspects in terms of the support on site. For example, there's always fires that pop up that sometimes the site managers don't always have time to deal with. So if an inspector comes to site and is like, I don't like this or this, you need to talk to the engineer. That's what I would be doing.
Yeah.
I would deal with the engineer, deal with the inspector, and try to solve that problem.
You don't want that time being consumed by your site, right?
Exactly. So okay. The main things that the site supervisor is supposed to do is there's really three main things. There's safety and security of the site. There's quality control. And essentially, I joke, a glorified babysitter.
Trade sitter. I call it trade sitter. Yeah,
trade sitter.
Yeah.
Just making sure that people show up and people clean up after themselves. It's really those three main things.
I do like that one little trick I saw online recently where it's like, if you don't want to clean up your mess, just put some cutoffs of wire on the mess, on the debris there, and then everyone will blame the electrician at that point. I'm like, it would actually work, because if you saw a little pile of dirt and you saw some wire there, your first thought as a trade, you'd be thinking it was a Sparky that did it.
This is what I tell trades now. If they don't want to comply with something, especially like cleaning up, just say no problem. I'm just going to keep this in mind for future projects when I'm tendering it out.
Simple as that.
They totally change their tune.
Of course. They don't understand how when it gets lean, like now, like the phone calls are going to be few and they're going to be very critical. Like you as a business owner, you're going to run through your Rolodex about how did that job go really? Like how did that trade do? How did that project turn out? Like you're going to think about all those things before hiring them again and saying, listen, I want you to do this job. And here's the opportunity for you.
Yeah, a lot of trades think it's just about the price. It's not about the price. I don't care so much about the price. The price is dictated based on past pricing. So our pricing is fairly accurate, usually within a plus minus 5% on the overall total of the project. But there's so many other factors that come into play. You could be half the price of someone else, but if you don't have the other factors like quality of work, good communication. Communication is a huge thing. Reliability.
Just transparency, keeping the client and the crew totally informed of everything that's happening.
Yeah.
Whether they're good and bad points during the project, just keeping them informed.
Like one thing very few trades do is at the end of the day, like just take some pictures, send them to me, give me an update of how it went. If you need to come back for another day, even though you were only scheduled to finish like today and you got to come back tomorrow, just let me know. Don't just show up the following day. If I have somebody booked and I have to push them, or if you guys have to work together, it's just about communication. That's the main thing. It's with, even with our clients, just having good communication, always being reachable. And I tell my clients that if I don't answer the phone, I'll call you back because either I'm in a meeting. Emails typically are a bit slower, but calls and texting, it's always usually within a few minutes to an hour that I'll respond.
Texting is the best. I mean, if I'm not in the country, texting is the best way to get a hold of me. Yeah. Second would be DM. Last would be a phone call. Like the phone calls are kind of hard, right? And then since I've ever changed to my phone to be vibrate all the time, I don't always see the phone going off at that time, right? So I'll see the notification coming from the text or the DM. But yeah, communication is and same thing with the trades. There's no reason how, I get that you're working. Doesn't matter what trade you are. You're in the middle of something, but you are going to be notified or you're going to feel that the phone has gone off. So then you got to just check it in between you're doing your work, right?
Mm-hmm. And I tell some of the trades, I say, I'd rather you call me 1,000 times than not at all. Because if you keep calling me, I'll give you the answers you need to have the finished product that we're expecting and the client's expecting. The worst is when the trades just make assumptions. They just assume that it should be this way or should be that way. But sometimes it's better not to make the assumptions and call for clarification unless you have prior rapport with that builder and you know that, okay, this builder likes it this way. Because every builder likes stuff slightly different.
Excuse me, sorry?
Because every builder likes things slightly different, right?
Yeah. There was one time I visited Jim Carrick's site, and it was one of these unicorn moments that I saw where he was just showing me the drawings of this really intricate home being built in a nice area of the city. And then after he showed me the drawings and he was just laying everything out, and I saw, and I was really respectful of, there was a lot of detail in the drawings, like a lot of detail. It was almost bringing me back to the old days of drawings where you see things that you could take this drawing and you can give it to anybody in the industry and they'll figure it out, right? But on top of that, there was that whole design book. So on top of the drawings being laid out, there was another larger book that almost, he shows me, he goes, have you ever seen one of these? And I was like, what are you talking about? He opens it up and it was literally every single item that was going in the house and the specs on it, the instructions on everything. Like we're talking about the appliances, we're talking about components, electronic components, we're talking about anything to do with details of that home was in that basically that catalog, right? And then you can flip through and it was actually connected to the drawings. So if there was a notation on the drawing of a specific design element and there was a number code to it, it was in the book and then explained to you. So then you can be on site and review it and you wouldn't have to make the phone call. Unless you really, it was a really complicated situation. But he was showing me this and I was like, dude, this is far and few. I've never seen this before. He goes, well, this is what sometimes you pay for, you know, you pay a premium for a certain architect, a certain designer. This is all part of their price. This is what they include. So then everybody's on board. Nobody needs, because at that point you get clients that don't have the time to be part of meetings constantly trying to review everything and making sure everybody's on board. You want trades to understand what's the objective here. And so here you go, and it's on site at all times.
But most of the time you don't get that, because I think
Jim's doing
more design build where he gets a client and then he'll bring in an architect and then he'll work with the client and the architect.
Or vice versa, the architect brings him in.
We're starting to do more of the design build lately, but if you're just given a set of drawings, you sort of have to figure out all the detail on your own.
Yeah.
For every job, whether it's a design build or just a build, we use Builder Trend. So in Builder Trend, we have all of our selections, all of our appliances, all of our fixtures, flooring, like everything. We make the client select everything before we even start construction. So it's similar to what he has, but we have it in like the digital version instead of like the physical.
Because you need these things, right? I like to think about the old school way of where you come on and not all the answers are there as kind of like, a crash course in construction. So at least if you're aware that this is missing, then when you do see it on the site, you're like, okay, I'm grateful that it's there now. Right. People are paying attention to it.
And especially when you're doing custom homes like he's doing, you got to have the detail.
Yeah.
because there's just the project itself, like the physical aspect is detailed, so it has to be also detailed on paper.
I want to ask you about, how's the inspection process been for you? Because we recently did a show where we're three times slower than the slowest part of America getting their inspections. Like we're, I think, at 280 days on average to get a permit.
So are you talking about permits or like inspections during construction specifically?
Permits and then inspections. But the, I guess the inspections are being okay. They're being all right these days. But
it depends on where you are in the city. I've noticed on the outskirts of the city, more East York, Scarborough, Etobicoke, specifically in Toronto, the inspectors are more easygoing. Once you get more to the downtown core, they pick up on everything, and some things are just absolutely ridiculous. I had an inspector on a project where there was a piece of blocking we did on the flat because we had a duct running through that joist cavity.
Okay.
And he's like, I need an engineer's report for this.
Are you fucking kidding?
I'm like, seriously? So I called up his supervisor and I asked his supervisor, I'm like, do I need an engineer's report for this? I've never heard of this ever.
No, you do not.
He's like, no.
So why was he being a dick?
It just depends on what side of the bed they wake up that day. Like with this guy specifically, I've noticed depending on how he feels. So sometimes he's easygoing, sometimes he's more tough.
So he's a repeat offender. He just depends on the mood he's coming in at.
Pretty much.
And he doesn't have the thought process that the sheathing on top has been glued, has been screwed. And then there's a blocking underneath that's anchoring the bottom point of the joist, yeah, which you're having the two points secured. So that
he's like, that's not how it's detailed in the drawing, so I'm not going to accept it.
But then here's the wicked world of the drawings, where they use the drawings for one purpose and then they don't use the drawings for another purpose. When you see something that was not put in the drawings, but you know is code, and you build it correctly, because if you built it as per the drawings, it'd be incorrectly, and it's an oversight on the building department's point, right? And then you point it out to them going, listen, this is the correct OBC way how to do it. But they won't object to that you corrected an incorrection on the drawings.
I'll give you another example with that same inspector. We did in-floor radiant heating. So our HVAC contractor wouldn't do it according to the plans because it was, in their opinion, it was incorrect. They had 12-inch spacing.
Who did the HVAC design?
HVAC engineer, okay, designer.
From the HVAC company or somebody else? Or from the
No, architect? It was totally separate. It was given to us from the architect. The architect hired an HVAC designer.
Okay.
So it was 12-inch loops. Our HVAC crew said that it's should be 9-inch, 12-inch. It just, they've never seen it, and it's just not efficient. Also shows in the drawings all the looping going under the cabinets when it's not supposed to go under the cabinets. So they also didn't put it under the cabinets. So the inspector gets there and he's like, well, why is it different than the drawings? I said, well, the drawings are incorrect. So I told him I can do it exactly per the drawings, but the drawings show that the looping has to go under the cabinets, but you're not supposed to do it under the cabinets.
There's no reason to put it under the cabinets.
Yeah. So he ended up accepting it this time. I guess he was in a good mood.
Same inspector.
And because we had the same issue with the basement for the main house, because this was for a laneway house. So we had to get an engineer's report at the time. So I said, you're going to make my client spend another $700 on this. When we gave you the one for the basement, it's going to say the exact same thing. So he let it go that time.
Maybe he's not as proficient in framing or in HVAC as he is in framing.
And I had another inspector this week on another site a few minutes away. And he was complaining about the shards from the wood against the PEX pipe when it goes through the joist. So he wants us to clean out all those shards.
You're talking about the tear out on the one side?
Yeah. Yeah. He wouldn't accept it.
Have you ever heard of a tear out damaging a PEX pipe in the history of construction?
Never. Yeah.
That's just being a dick.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes it's easier just to comply depending on what it is than to fight back on
it. So how do you comply with that, Kyle? Like, do you call the plumber because they're the one that drilled the hole?
Yeah.
Or do you handle it, or do you get a labor on site to handle it?
It depends on if the plumber's already done his work and it's just a few shards, then I can just do it myself. Or if I next time I have a handyman or a laborer there, they can just do it. But the plumber was coming back to do some other stuff anyways, so he just took care of it.
Listen, I've always noticed plumbers or electricians or even HVAC people, there's three things that they do when they drill a hole. Three things that they do that are good when they drill a hole. First, they check to see the other side that there's nothing there, right? Second, they drill the hole. And third, they wipe the joist to clean all the shards. I've always seen that. Like and they just repeat that over and over and over and over, right? So if you're just, I guess, running, gunning, and just drilling, 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 that's how you get a mistake happening, right? Because you'll hit something if you're not paying attention.
We've had that happen recently on a couple of projects. The electrician drilled. He saw I think it was like a gas line or a drain line on. It wasn't filled with gas. It was just roughing. He saw it on the other side, and he accidentally still drilled through it. So we had to get those repaired, and it happened a couple times within like a week span.
It was Warflex, right?
Warflex is the yellow flexible one.
Yellow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
See, what's kind of funny is ever since they got rid of the hard pipe, like he would never have been able to pierce the hard pipe, right? But hard pipe would have cost so much more time and money to do it. But I'm a fan of the flexible too. But when I see it, it's so easy to drill through it. Like it is so easy to drill through it, right?
Yeah, especially sometimes like when you're drilling, you can see the pipe on the other side, but it's just like that last little bit when it pokes through. It's just the force of it. Sometimes it's hard to rein it back.
I wish architects would start getting into the mindset of creating channels like the hell they do for commercial construction. So there's always channels for all your mechanical runs, right? Like you just, everybody chases down this one avenue, and it would make life a lot easier instead of having to get all the trades to drill through so many holes through joists to get through all their stuff, right?
Well, what happens in commercial is I think they're using more 3D modeling.
Yeah.
So they can see those mechanicals and how they run and cross over each other. But at the same time, there is more cohesive team. You have somebody that's managing the architect, the HVAC, the electrical engineer, and sort of bridging the gaps for all that stuff. But with residential, you have an architect who will just get an HVAC designer. Oh, great, you did your plans. Okay, I'm not even going to double check it to make sure that everything flows together. I'm just going to accept your plans, and then I'm just going to put it in for the permit application.
See, that's the problem, though. You're getting an HVAC designer who doesn't even go on site to kind of take a look at the progress. They're just looking at the drawings, and then they're calculating their design based on those drawings.
The worst is HVAC designers in renovations when they don't see it. I can understand for a new build, but for a renovation, we had one. It was just a small little addition. They're like, oh, just extend the trunk line.
No.
It's like, just extend it. Where is the trunk line?
No, you can't do that.
And secondly, what type of runs am I supposed to get off that trunk line?
Yeah.
And then we had a whole issue trying to figure that out. And then I asked the architect, I'm like, well, why didn't you bring the HVAC designer to site in the first place? He's like, it would have cost the client more money. It's like, so what? It's part of the process.
It's going to cost more money now when we have to try to figure it out on site.
Yeah.
Right? A lot easier to do it on a pencil on a drawing than it is on a sledgehammer on a site. Frank Lloyd Wright. That's basically the mindset. You can't leave everything to the trades to solve on site.
And that's why we've started getting into design build, is just because there's just so much frustration of what we've been given and how poor planning and oversight there's been. It's not even just the poor planning. It's also about what you've designed doesn't tailor to the client's budget. So if the client has a budget of $500,000 and you're designing something that's going to cost $700,000, well, now the client has to spend more money to get the drawings redesigned, or they have to find more money to build what you've designed.
Yeah. You ever ask the clients if they asked the architect what the budget of this would have been construction-wise?
Yeah, sometimes they do. And usually the architect is incorrect.
Oh, always the architect's incorrect. Unless it's an architect that's also a builder. Somebody who's very familiar with what it really cost, and that's rare, because that's not the majority of what's going on. But they're always giving you almost this TV discounted price to the clients to keep them happy, because now you're they're babysitting their client. They're just trying to keep their client happy and making sure that they don't fire me. So then they're going to tell me, yeah, this is about a $500,000 reno. then once you start tendering it out to builders, they're going to tell you it's a $700,000 rental.
Yeah, that's why it's always good to have a builder involved from the beginning, because not only can the builder foresee challenges that may happen on site, at the same time, the builder can give you budget updates as they go along.
So I've always said it's not the ABCs, it's the BACs. It's the builder first, the architect second, and the construction third. That's generally how it should work. The client should find the builder, start having a conversation with them. This is the type of house we want to build. This is what we're thinking about. What do you think is a rough ballpark? Builder starts giving you some realistic numbers, and then you start giving it to the architect, and then you start working in conjunction, and then you start going back and forth, and then guess what? The client is given the right number, you know, within probably 10 points at that point. And then all of a sudden they're like, okay, we're not over, we're not under, we're right on bang.
That's so it. When we're doing a design build, we, for our, like our ballpark, our preliminary, without having any information other than like square footage, bedrooms, bathrooms, and just seeing site conditions, is like plus minus approximately 20%.
Okay.
And then every time you develop the drawings after preliminary, it gets down to 15%.
Okay.
After the architectural and before the consultants, 10%. And once you have all the consultants, then it's plus minus 5%. And we hold that plus minus 5% into construction itself. Because last time I was here, we were talking about a little bit of cost plus and fixed costs. We were doing fixed costs at the time. In the last year, we've moved more over to cost plus. And
what was the primary behind that?
It's more so that we were finding with fixed cost that we weren't making as much as we wanted, because there is just unknown variables. And then if you were try to build in that 5%, you would have been maybe too high on the job to get the job.
Yep.
That 5% buffer. But now with the cost plus, not only is our gross profit more accurate, it's actually within, I think our gross profit is on average 20%. We're within 0.0% of that 20%. So just slightly under. So overall on that 20%, it's like a less than 1% margin. So there's more predictability in terms of our income and our overhead with cost plus.
So with the fix, you were not that close. You were probably 5% off?
Sometimes you could be 5% off, and then now your profit is down at 15% gross.
Yeah.
Which doesn't cover the expenses. But also in the last couple of years, we've been constantly updating our budgets. We have a feedback loop because we're doing about 15 projects a year now, of the size projects we do, anywhere from half a mil to a mil. We have this feedback loop that we get the prices in, we update the budgets, and then as the new drawings come into price, it's based on recent and current data. So it's, for us, it's all about the data and the numbers. It's the numbers speak volumes. Whatever the numbers say is what it is in terms of historical data.
So now, what are some of the big numbers that are fluctuating those estimates when you're submitting them? Are we still talking material? Material was the I mean, as much as everybody was working peak-wise.
Things have been getting more stable recently in terms of pricing, for sure. We've actually been coming under budget a little bit on the last few jobs. Like, for example, siding. Our siding budget, we could not find a siding company that had reasonable prices. We contacted probably 60 to 70 companies over the last few years. Just this year, we finally found a company that has reasonable prices, good communication, and good quality of work. So now our siding budget is going to be about 30% lower than it previously was, just because we didn't have the data and the trades for the lower prices for that line item specifically. But then there's some other things like millwork. Millwork has started creeping up a little bit. I think we were budgeting $500 or $600 a square foot.
The custom material or the labor itself? Or
just
both?
The supply and install for cabinets. I think we were doing like $500 or $600 a linear foot. But now with the recent prices that have come in, we have to raise that, I think, like $50 or $75 a linear foot.
So what's the pool of data that you're working with? I mean, has it been a steady climb for the last 5 years, so to speak, for you guys, where you guys have been growing, like, project-wise?
Yeah, we've been growing project-wise in terms of, I would say, dollar amount, as well as in terms of the number of projects. Like, right now we have 12 projects going on.
For this year?
Currently.
Currently going on, but that's not for the total year. What was last year like for you?
Last year, I think we had about 10 projects for the whole year. So that 12 projects that we have right now, we still have three more that we're starting before the end of the year.
Okay.
When I was last on a couple of years ago, I think we only had about 4 or 5 jobs at the same time.
Yeah. So there's been growth there, but you're still looking back at that data and realizing, okay, so what was the material like? What was the labor like? What was the time like? And you're inputting all that to these projects this year.
Well, data from 2 or 3 years ago, we don't really use anymore. It's really, we're just using the last 12 months.
Okay.
Because that's going to be the most up-to-date and the most accurate.
You can't use the COVID peak, right?
Correct.
Because it's incorrect knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, you're using the end of 2023 kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So basically a year from, all right. And then it helps you get a quote out faster.
Yeah, because what we do is we import these numbers into our system, and we have two ways of estimating. We have our ballpark calculator, which is just a spreadsheet where we pull out all the values, for example, for framing, lumber and labor. We have a cost per square foot. Cabinets, we have a cost per linear foot.
Yep.
Drywall, again, cost per square foot. Because we have so much data, we can get these cost per square foot or linear foot values to input into our system. It all gets put into the ballpark calculator. And then all we need to do is to come up with the ballpark is we have to input some data. Is it I'll use laneway and garden suites as an example, because that's right now what our ballpark calculator caters to, is how many stories is it? How many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, and what's the square footage? Over time, you can get that more accurate.
Yeah.
So, for example, you have a garage. A garage might bring the cost per square foot slightly down overall because there's not as much finishing
mm-hmm.
for the garage.
I get it. I understand what you're saying. Are you having are clients surprised when you start talking to them about laneway suites that they cost per square footage more than actually building a house? Are they surprised by that?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It also depends on the square footage of the laneway suite or garden suite itself, because it's a sliding scale. So yeah, a one story is going to be cost differently than a two story, because yeah, a two story, you need a set of stairs versus if it's a one story or a two story, you still have the same. Let's say you're taking a 600 square foot footprint for a one story, and then you just double that, so you have 1200 for a two story. You still have a kitchen in both, but over a two-story, you can spread out the cost, so it's less per square foot.
Yeah.
Same thing with a roof or a foundation. It's the same square footage, the same amount of work. That's why a one-story can cost $700 to $800 a square foot, but a two-story can cost $400 to $500 a square foot.
Is the city allowing us to do... They're not allowing us to do three stories yet, right?
You can
maybe do two stories on a rooftop deck kind of thing.
So we have one that we're doing. It's a three-story laneway house, but technically it's an addition because there's a corridor connecting the main house to that laneway house. Because it's a commercial residential property, you're not actually allowed to build laneway houses on commercial residential properties.
Okay.
So you have to have this corridor connecting the two. And so that's how we were able to get three stories.
So it's an extension of the main dwelling.
Yeah, technically. We're just a hallway connecting them.
Okay, yeah. And how has that process been? Because I know a lot of people have been having a hard time getting their permits, getting everything ready to go.
So we were in that one from the early stages, but they started in 2020, the process on that project.
And you're just building now?
And we're just building it. We actually signed the contracts for the build a year ago, and a year later is when we started the build, because wow, the city was just taking a long time approving the permit. They also had to go to committee of adjustment for that. So that took probably a year in between.
For the commercial one, the zone, that particular one?
I don't think they had to change the zone. Yeah, maybe it was.
What was the COA for? What was the reason?
Yeah, you might be right. Maybe it was just doing the residential unit instead of the commercial unit for that extension.
Like sometimes I wonder what goes on in the building department. Like when they see the application come through, do they just ignore it like someone ignoring a text or something like that? Like I don't understand. Or do they actually just put it in the queue and start working on it?
I just don't think they have enough people
to work
and enough qualified people.
Okay.
To go through all this stuff. We had a laneway suite that we're working on right now, and we applied for a permit revision back in March, and it still hasn't been released because there are some issues with fire code that the city caught after the fact, and they're like, oh, you got to make these adjustments, otherwise we're going to revoke your permit. It's like, what do you mean you're going to revoke the permit? We've already done the foundation. How can you revoke the permit? You've already approved it. Because we had a nosy neighbor.
So you were in construction starting, permit approved, issued.
Yeah.
And then they put a hold light on it?
Because the neighbor, you're having issues with the neighbor. He's got nothing better to do other than just bug us and call the city all day. So he was looking into the bylaws and he saw the fire access route wasn't adequate. It was going through a shared laneway, walkway, which was actually his property. That was the supposed fire route. Then it had to get switched to the laneway. We were actually 3 meters short of what the requirement is, because from the laneway curb to the front door of that laneway house, it's a maximum of 90 meters. If it's more than that for fire access and emergency access, then you just can't build the laneway house unless you have access through the side. But if your access is through the side of the houses, you need 1 meter width of clearance. And if it's over your property line, you have to get an LDA, limiting distance agreement, with your neighbor. But of course, this neighbor wouldn't sign off on it. And then it went back to the city. And so now we have to do fire alarm system, fire shutters. Each fire shutters is another $5,000, and there was two of them, so that's another $10,000.
See, I don't understand. Okay, so was that fire access for firefighters to get into the dwelling in the event, or is it fire access for people to exit the dwelling from the laneway side of it instead of from the front of the dwelling?
I think it's more so just for the firefighter access and emergency services like ambulance or the stretcher.
How many laneways have you driven down in Toronto? Like, I've driven down quite a few, right?
Yeah, a lot.
All the garages are literally right tight to each other. There is no access. You have to go through the garage.
Yeah, so the emergency services wouldn't be driving down the laneway. The reason why they have that 90 meters max is because I guess that's how long their fire hoses are. And they have the 1 meter wide clearance because that's what they need for a stretcher to get by.
Yeah, so now, okay, so you're building a dwelling now and you're asking for all this fire protection. So you're putting sprinklers in, you're putting shutters in, you're putting all kinds.
No sprinklers on this one. I actually don't know what the criteria is for needing sprinklers in a laneway or garden suite. We've never had to do them. But the fire alarm system, so what it is, you have like a strobe light on the outside of the building that will flash. It's hooked up to the smoke detector. So if the smoke detectors go off, this strobe light will flash as well as there's a panel on the inside that I think hooks directly up to the fire department. So they get notified if there's an issue.
And then the homeowner will get a bill if it's a false alarm.
Probably. And they also have to pay a monthly charge of.
Oh, you have to pay a monthly?
Yeah. I don't know what it is. We haven't actually installed one before. This is the first one that we're going to be doing. So we got the quote, and I think it was like $30 a month or something for the monitoring.
How did the homeowner react to all these extras?
He wasn't happy, but he didn't really have a choice. And
you can't continue construction without doing this.
Pretty much, yeah. Like we still built the building. We're at we finished the framing. We're starting mechanical rough-ins next week. Still don't have the revised permit. Because then the city threw on another curveball. They're like, well, now we need you to pay. It's $200 for a permit revision.
Okay.
But now they threw on another $3,000 charge for like the TDSB charge. I don't know what it is. It's obviously for the Toronto School Board. But why do we have to pay this now when we already had the permit?
What's that charge? I don't understand what that charge would be.
Some development fee.
So you're paying into the school board?
Yeah.
For what purpose?
I have no idea.
Man, I keep saying Toronto's one of the most corrupt cities in North America.
Oh, on top of that, on the same project, the same neighbor has a tree. It's a massive tree. And we have to excavate for a walkout at the front of the house.
Okay.
So we also have a city protected tree. We have all the hoarding, the horizontal. We have the like 2x4s up around the trunk of it. So we had to get an arborist to supervise the dig. And that was for our tree originally. But then the city flagged this neighbor's tree. And they're like, well, you have this neighbor's tree here. Now we want you to pay a $17,000 deposit on this tree. So we did the dig. We got it supervised. And now they're not releasing it. Because now they're saying, because you're replacing those interlocked stones, it's going to affect the tree. So we're
the
not
neighbor's
gonna,
tree.
Yeah. So we're not going to release it until you finish all of your landscaping. Which is ridiculous because the city employee that was previously on the file said, all you need to do is dig this, supervised by an arborist, and then we'll release the funds. And we have all this stuff in email, in writing. So we sent all the screenshots to this city guy who's on the file now of the previous person who was on the file. Haven't heard back yet because this was just on Friday, but it's ridiculous that they just keep bringing up more and more stuff, more roadblocks, more curveballs, and then they just take no responsibility or accountability afterwards. When one person says this, then the other person says this. They also have no communication internally, is what I've realized.
That's part of the poor management of this city. It's done by design. Like, they just refuse to. They understand that these organizations should be communicating with each other, but they don't allow for that to happen. Which basically just prolongs the process of construction now. Instead of you finishing a project, because obviously you submit a quote, you also are submitting internally a timeline. But you're giving that timeline to the client as well, too. So you're getting this quote, you're seeing this project, for lack of a simpler term, you've got a whiteboard. This project starts in March. It's going to end in September. But now you're dealing with all this stuff that's going on in May, June, and July, which is going to affect September.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, this is the city doing this.
We have a Gantt chart of all of our projects, when they start, when they finish, how many slots we have open. And then as projects get delayed, you have to keep closing off spots for new projects because of all these delays, whether it's city or otherwise.
Now, as a business owner, you can't go back and charge like fees on top of this because now this is consuming part of your profit, right? Because you're spending more time and effort managing this job. And then you have to let your crews know, okay, you guys can't go any further on this project. I'm going to move you guys to this project now. And you have to start working on this project until we get the answer from the city on this project. Then I'll get you guys back on that project.
Yeah. And then you have the trade contracted for multiple projects. The other project was delayed, so they're going to hop on this one. But now you have another one started, but they also have to go back on this one. Now they're colliding on multiple projects on your sites. Now you're waiting for payment on this one because that one's not done, but you can't have the crew there to get, so you can get the payment from the client until they finish up that one, which was supposed to be this one and then that one and then that one.
Do you think things will change after October of next year? And I say that because of the election, right? Because, you know, Pierre's obviously talked about how municipalities will not be funded if they continue to gatekeep on this, right?
Who knows? He sounds genuine. I've heard him speak a lot. Usually, if you listen to someone speak or see them speak, usually after a certain amount of hours, you can sort of get a gauge for what they're really about. You can see through the bullshit if you see enough.
Yeah.
I believe he's genuine, but at the end of the day, he's still a career politician.
Of course.
So you don't know. It's either going to go one of two ways. Either he's going to reform this country for the good and people are going to praise him, or he's not going to do anything and then he's going to get burned at the stake.
I think he's going to do something in the beginning, and then I think he will just become what our government is all about. And I don't, like, you're right, 100%. Career politicians, from the week that they get into power, their political agenda is about staying in power. It's not about taking care of the people. So, like, there's a cause and effect where I keep arguing with certain government programs that are training new kids to come into this industry, how they're using hot topic buttons to convince kids. I'm just using the word kid. It could be older people getting into construction as well, but people in general getting into construction. And then there's a lot of government funding thrown at these programs to get these people into construction, to start pre-training them to get them into our industry, right? But they ignore us. So we're going through all the crap that you guys are going through, where it's this gatekeeping going on, this permit process. When they started talking multi, you know, dwelling projects and laneway suites and all this other stuff, there was never a media bite of the asshole neighbor that's going to object to any of this, and it's going to create a delay in the process. Never a media bite on that. How that should have been a media bite. It should have been, you should have heard from Ford saying, if a neighbor wants to complain, then they can complain, but they can't stop the process. That's how it should have been, but that's not happening. A neighbor gets the right to complain, and then the city has to fulfill the obligations of listening to that neighbor, but it delays your process, and that's what I'm getting at. So where it's like construction starts, but then it pauses. And then it starts and it pauses. And I'm like, that's not being efficient. So you got this entire workforce coming into this industry, and the industry is fighting the bureaucracy of trying to get projects completed properly. And all we're trying to do is build it properly. Where nobody that I've ever met in construction wants to build something like shit that is going to fall apart. They always want to build it properly and get it done correctly. We understand that building department personnel might oversee something. We understand that an architect might oversee something, engineer, a builder, trade, everybody oversees things. But if we're all on site and our objective is to correct it and fix it, then let's get it done without the time being wasted. There's so much time.
That's the other thing with the building inspectors is they come to site. They're like, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. And they don't really tell you what you need to do sometimes to solve or correct it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's for you to figure out. It's like at the end of the day, we're
should not be that way.
We need to work together as a team for the benefit of the client and the end user. But for the city inspectors to always fight us on everything, just tell me what I need to do to satisfy you in order to get this passed.
It's a liability issue. So I've had enough conversations with inspectors off mic. They can't tell you what to do because then you could hold them accountable if you do it and it goes wrong.
Or at least point me to the in the right direction in the building code.
And then they'll say, well, you know, you'll get a builder that will say, well, the inspector told me to take a look at this building code here, and this is what I did. And then it's liability. So it keeps on going back to liability. But it's a double edge because now you got them coming in here, and they're using the rule of liability against us. You can't do it that way. It's the same thing with Ministry of Labor. It's the same way. Like, that you can't. I still challenge any MOL agent, a roofer, tell me where to tie off, or a framer doing roof rafters, tell me where to tie off. There's no place to tie off. That's not my problem. That's your problem. You have to figure it out. But if I come here and you're working on that roof and you're not tied off somewhere, even though you physically can't tie off anywhere, that's not my problem. I can still fine you.
But even if you are tied off, depending on the situation, sometimes it's even more dangerous.
Oh, I know.
Now you have a rope dangling right at your feet. And it's very easy to trip on the rope.
I mean, that's just a sidebar. But, I mean, I do respect the UK things, you know, Irish and also British.
They do, like, almost all scaffolding, right?
But it's a cost thing, right? Yeah. So it's like all of a sudden the cost of the roof to do the roof is going to jump 50% because now you're going to put, yeah, but the safety is taken care of. Everything's, and then at that point, you can get eavesdrops done properly. You can get a bunch of stuff done properly without people doing this Cirque du Soleil act on ladders. You know what I mean?
Like, how great would it be if you could set up scaffolding before you even do anything on the build, all around the height that it's going to be, set up a tarp. Now you're essentially working in sort of like a factory.
It's a great idea, but then who's going to absorb that cost?
Exactly.
It goes to the client, and the client will never eat that cost because they want to save it for the bells and whistles later on. How are you, your clients are word of mouth, right?
No.
You're actually promoting?
Almost never.
Really?
Word of mouth. Yeah, it's all just advertising.
Where are you focusing your efforts on advertising?
I think the reason why, because our clients are not word of mouth, is we're still a fresh business, 5 or 6 years. And we've only started doing the types of projects we're doing maybe about three and a half years ago. So sometimes it takes years for those referrals to build up, especially if the duration of the project is 1 year. Mm-hmm. So by the time a lead comes in, we could sign it in 2 months or it could be 3 years. And then construction is another year. So really the whole process for us to get through a whole sales and build cycle is anywhere from 3 to 5 years.
So it's hard to get the word of mouth out of that.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? Where are you advertising?
We're doing a lot of Google ads.
They're working for you?
They are working.
Are you tweaking them every?
We haven't been tweaking recently, but we're looking at doing that because the person who does all of our marketing is sort of tied up with doing other things. So we just hire like an admin assistant for him to free up more of his time to focus on more A/B testing of stuff like Google ads. We've recently started delving into Instagram ads. There's something that I found out like last year that the city of Toronto and other municipalities, I think it's only Brampton and the city of Toronto, they offer all of their permits online. So what I did was I downloaded all of the permits, the permit numbers, the addresses. It also shows the type of project. And I literally sent out 5,000 letters to all of these addresses to try to get business.
What was the return on it? Like lead wise, did you get what percentage?
I think it was about 1%.
Still a good number.
Yeah. So 5,000, 1% is what, about 5? Or is that 50?
No, it's 50.
50. No, so then it wasn't 1%. So we got probably about 10 or 15 calls from that.
That they wanted to have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
About a future project.
Yeah, and in terms...
Did you look at the permit and the scope of the permit and realize they might be wanting to do something bigger later on?
I didn't really spend the time going through all that. So what I started out doing is the first batch of letters that I sent out, it was, I just looked for the tag addition or laneway suite. There was about 700 of them. So I sent out all the letters for that. Then I went more broader and just anything regarding residential projects. Then so I sent out all the permit letters for that. So it was actually, I got actually a higher callback rate on the more focused, the additions and the laneways versus the more broader ones. And in terms of have we signed any jobs yet from that? No, but we still have a few of the leads sort of in the hopper as opportunities.
But you're planting seeds. That's all you're
exactly.
doing.
Exactly. It's about planting those seeds. And like I said, sometimes it could be up to 3 years before we sign a client.
How much time do you figure, Kyle, that you spent doing that? Like, was it a work week? Was it a work month?
It was probably, I didn't do everything myself. So I just got the list. I sorted through everything. Then I had to download a plugin where it converts everything from the spreadsheet and map it onto an envelope. So it automatically maps it onto the envelope. Then I could print the envelopes. Then I had somebody else put the stamps together and put all the, like, it's just like a one page document inside of the envelope.
You're writing letters and mailing letters to everybody?
We're not writing physically.
No, but you're using a computer, but you're it's a physical paper that you're mailing. You're not emailing
people. Yeah, because there's no other way to do it because all we have is their address from that database. We don't have anything else. If there was emails or calls, I would 100% do that first.
No, but it makes sense. It wouldn't be... Mississauga has emails, though.
Mississauga, I looked into it. They don't give you the whole access to the database. You actually have to search on a address by address basis. Ugh. Yeah, so
what a pain in the ass.
It's really just Toronto, and Brampton was another.
What's the favorite city that you like working in?
We only work in Toronto.
Toronto, so how far east and how far west and how far north?
So we'll go up to Steeles.
Okay.
Scarborough and Etobicoke. That's sort of our borderline, but we have two main pockets of work. One is in East York and the other one is like around the Bathurst, Bloor, Bathurst, Dundas area.
Was it a pain in the ass for you to get around the LRT construction? Like just the logistics? No?
Not really, because we don't really have many projects. That's like near Eglinton, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it hasn't really affected us.
Okay. And it's been good for you guys so far?
Yeah.
And then I'm just curious on the clientele. Like, is it a wide range? Are you getting elderly people that are downsizing? You're getting young homeowners that are buying their second home that might be their forever home?
So I would say the average client age is anywhere from like 40 to 60. Because it's for the type of projects that we're doing, mostly laneway and garden suites. We also do like additions and been getting into multiplex conversions, single family home and converting into multiple units. It's either they're doing it for like a unit for their parents or for their kids.
Yep.
Sometimes for themselves, they'll move into the backyard unit and then they'll give their parents or the kids the main house.
Yep.
Usually the kids, they'll give the main house as their family grows, and essentially their plan is just sort of repeat the cycle. Then the kids can move into the back, and then their kids.
So primarily is to keep it generational. It's not for the income of trying to get tenants in there.
We've noticed recently in the last year and a half or so that it's been more multi-generational. During the COVID boom, it was almost all rental, but also there's been sort of a shift, right? Because laneway suites, you have the separate access.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes sense from a separate rental perspective. But for garden suites, where the access is going through essentially the side of the house, that's why those have been more multi-generational. Now, do people still rent them out? Of course, but it's sort of been mostly rental for laneway and mostly multi-generational for garden suites.
But it's interesting that you're saying that is, that's got to be because of the economy. It's got to be because of the pricing of houses and how they realize that their kids' kids will not be able to afford to buy a house. But if you can build a laneway suite now, or at least divide up your main dwelling into a certain way, then your kids and your kids' kids might have something to own.
Exactly.
And keep it in the family at that point. Keep title in the family, right? So then you don't have to deal with until the current government changes more rules in the game, right?
And that's why I also think that it's multi-generational more for the garden suites, because you can still live in the main house while that's going on. But if you want to convert the main house, converting the main house into multiple units, it's still more geared towards rental. Because if you're converting the main house, you really can't live there. So now you don't have a place to live. Now you got to go spend more money somewhere else to rent until that's ready.
See, I don't think that people understand. Sometimes I look back on my backyard and I just picture a garden suite or a laneway suite in each person's backyard and what this would look like. And I don't think people really can grasp the congestion that this would create. Because for each unit that someone's living there, whether it's a laneway or a garden that has two units in it, so now you got two tenants and you got two more vehicles, right? So parked on the street. Now you times that by every single house that's on that street. The congestion has not really been a factor in this whole thing.
Correct. No one's really thought of that. I think by the time congestion becomes an issue, it's going to be so far down the road. But yes, we should start planning for it now. So I'll give you an example for Brampton. Brampton approved the suites maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years. They've only had like 15 permit applications when I checked.
That's nothing.
A few months ago. Toronto has had, I think now, over 1,000 applications. Still, and how many have they had built?
Handful.
I think it was like 100 or 200. It wasn't many. Yeah. And then there's a certain portion of that 1,000 that have just canceled their permit entirely, which could have been another 5%.
It's got to be because of the process. Like, people are getting frustrated on the process. You're getting frustrated by the neighbors arguing, complaining, objecting. Then you got to go to COA. And you got, like, there was somebody on the show. And we were talking about somebody was tied in with the government. So then they knew somebody. So they objected to a permit that was being proposed. And ultimately, she gave up. She said, I'm not going to fight this, because that neighbor was making it too difficult for her to get the approval.
Well, because laneway suites and garden suites are as of right, unless you want to do something that's outside of the bylaw, make it taller. Garden suites, you have to have 10% of your lot frontage setback on each side if you want. So if you have a 20-foot lot, you need 2 feet on each side.
Okay.
On the lot line. If you want to shrink that down to 1 foot, then you would have to go to committee of adjustment.
Okay.
But for the most part, they're as of right, and it'll just go right through the permit. As long as you follow all the bylaws. And that's what they've recently approved for the multiplexes. So the multiplexes now are as of right, as long as you follow the bylaws. And then another thing that just came out recently. So I think the multiplex has been about a year now. But now they're doing, as of right, for major streets is up to 60 units, which is huge. Because if you wanted to do anything with a large amount of units, you'd have to essentially rezone, committee of adjustment. But now you don't necessarily have to do that.
I know, but based on the numbers that you just said about Brampton's numbers and Toronto's numbers, there aren't that many units being approved or going through the process.
I think it's from the client perspective. I just don't think enough people know about this. From the city perspective, I just, like you said, they're just not pushing enough through, or there's just too many delays. But even like the 60 units, that's limited. That's more of like a developer or someone with lots of money that can fund a project like that. So for the average consumer, it's not even going to be multiplexes, because multiplexes, converting a single family to 4 or 5 units, that could still cost $1.5 million. So the backyard home, specifically one story, is what's going to be affordable for most people. About 450 to 600 square feet costs all in HST, soft costs like design, usually upwards of around $500,000. And that's what's usually more affordable and in the price point for more people. Then on the flip side, if this is like traditional, like stick built, one piece at a time. On the flip side of it, you have the prefab. Like I heard a show, I think it was maybe 15 episodes ago, you had someone on that bought a factory.
Yeah, from Faro International.
From one of the big companies. Modular. But that, it's great. But for certain areas, like you can't necessarily do that in the urban core of Toronto.
Prefab doesn't work in it won't work.
It's great if you have more openness and more land.
Yeah.
Now, is prefab possible in areas that are more spread out like Scarborough and Etobicoke? Definitely. It's still based on the lot, and I think it's very difficult to come up with one design that's going to work for multiple lots because of the setbacks. And there's a lot of lots that sometimes are just like an angle shaped where you have to make a custom design around it. But it's great where you have lots of space. So subdivisions are starting to not be as many as there used to be, because we're running out of land and you got to go more towards the outskirts.
Yeah.
So they would just do the traditional built-in place. But now with prefab is coming up more in modular, I think that would be great for subdivisions, because you have so much space. And if you have a factory close by, very easy to ship it out to that subdivision. You could even potentially build the factory on location at the subdivision if you can figure out a way to make a factory to pop it up and bring it down and move it fairly easily.
That's already happening,
right?
With
tents.
Yeah, that's already happening, where you can actually park a seat can and pull out your components that you need and build on site right then and there. And you're building prefab kind of modular on site at that point, right? You'd almost, it's sad that subdivisions are slowing down. That's just a fact, right? So you're seeing a lot of projects being paused right now because they can't sell the homes to people buying in this climate right now. Nobody's buying. Pre-cons have slowed down. The only thing that's going is multi, but multi has this paperwork nightmare that's going on that you've gone through. You're still going through. Other people that are trying to get into it are going through. Excuse me. And I think what happens is homeowners look at it like, okay, sure, 400 square feet, $500,000. That's realistically on the low end, that's what it would cost. But now you start getting into, let's say you get into that fire situation now. You start adding to that $500,000. Now you get a client or a neighbor that's going to complain. And then you get homeowners will sit down and go, well, here's our balance sheet. This is what this is going to cost us to build, right? And then when they calculate it and they try to figure out, where's this money coming from? How long is it going to take to replace this money? Whether we rent it out or whatever the story is. And they look at it like, the ROI in it isn't there for them. So then they put a pause on it. So they don't do it. And I think that's part of the reason why there's too many red flags happening that are associated with these units that we need to get rid of. So then we can get more of these units being built. but they're not being built as fast as the media is portraying them to be built.
Well, I've never really seen much media portraying that there's a lot of units or that they're being built fast. Like from the articles that I've read recently, it's more so like it's more underwhelming. Like, oh, only 30 permits have actually completed construction for Garden Suites. I saw an article like, I don't know, a few months back regarding that stuff.
Remember 2 years ago when Ford was talking about, we're going to just streamline the process. We're going to get this out. This has been approved and all this other shit. And then every person I know that has been going down
was
this
that
road.
2 years right around election time?
Yeah, it was basically. Yeah. Like I said, politicians' priority is to stay in power. So you'll say there's certain things just to stay in power. But the thing is, the truth is that they're not doing anything correctly. They're slowing down the process. And you're getting building officials that are not familiar with this process. I think builders probably have more familiarity with it than the building department does. They understand multi. They understand the process and how to build one of these units more than the city does.
Like we had one just last week where we were doing a service tie-in for the drains. So we tied in inside the house, downstream of the backwater valve. The inspector comes and he's like, no, you can't tie in inside. It's like, what do you mean? It's like, you got to tie in outside of the house. I'm like, I've built probably more than anyone else in the city of Toronto. And you're telling me it can't be done like this? You've already set precedents in the city to do it this way. And there's also certain sites where it's impossible to tie in the front of the house. You have to go through the basement.
Yeah.
Anyways, we kept pushing back and challenging him. He's like, oh, my manager is making me tie in through the front of the house. I have some documentation I'll provide you. I'm like, okay, great. Give me the documentation. The next day he calls back and he's like, yeah, it's been approved. Because he couldn't back it up with the documentation.
Simple as that. Right? But that's what I mean, is that you've got a building department and their inspectors not understanding what you guys are going through. So I almost wish the politicians would start asking the workforce, how should we do this? So we can give them the right answers. But I know they don't want these answers because they don't line up with their bites that they want out there.
Yeah, definitely. It's sad that there's so many things in government that could be so much better if they just bring in qualified professionals that actually have experience. Instead of assigning someone to be a finance minister of our country that doesn't have any experience regarding that, or housing minister that doesn't have any experience. Housing minister should really be someone that's been in the industry, should be assigned
should be a builder.
Like that role.
Should be a builder. You should have a bare minimum of I don't know, a decade of experience of actually building homes. Like you should. I get it, but the problem is that the industry doesn't want to be in suits and the suits don't want to be in the industry. So you get the industry dictating what we should do, which is incorrect. But that's a whole other world of discussions that we can't really get into at that point. But the thing is, I mean, do you still see the economy getting worse right now just before it gets better? Or is it already on the uptick of getting better?
I don't know. It's earlier this year, everybody was saying rate cuts, rate cuts, rate cuts.
Yeah,
we've gotten one rate cut. I was saying earlier this year that I thought there was going to be a rate increase before a rate cut, because usually what I've come to realize is whatever the mass market and mass media says, usually the opposite happens. It's like a couple of years ago, everybody was like, oh, we're going into a recession. Well, that didn't happen. Now everybody's like, it's just going to keep going up. So maybe a recession's around the corner.
Yeah. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I've been telling anybody who reaches out to me asking me about if there's any work out there, whatever. I said, listen, just hunker down and just prepare and then set the ego aside and look for whatever work you can. Go back to your original roots, man, and just start figuring it out. And it's like, commend you for making those letters and reaching out and having that idea to even just reach out to that permit angle. Like that will probably generate a lead or two for you because of that.
Yeah. And it all comes down to just sometimes taking risks. It costs like $5,000 or $6,000 to send out all those letters.
Yeah.
Between the labor, the letters, the stamps are like $1 each.
I know, eh?
It probably even costs us more than that with the labor.
But if you get a lead out of it, that turns into a client or even two.
comes down to LTV over CAC. That's lifetime value over client acquisition costs.
Yeah.
So if your average job size is $500,000, costs you $5,000 to get a job, that's 1%. So just figure 1% of sales is going to get you the work that you need.
Are you getting approached by kids, like people right out of school wanting to get work from you, or?
No,
not really.
Really had that.
Yeah. Because you're ingrained in the workforce, right? You've got experienced people in the workforce that are coming at you.
Yeah, like right now, I mentioned earlier, we're hiring for a site manager role, and there's people that want ridiculous amount for very little experience. Guys that are in their early to mid-20s that are wanting $90,000 to $100,000 when they've only been in the industry for 4 or 5 years.
They're not thinking long-term relationships. And I'll just share a real quick story of somebody that I met 6 years ago in concrete. It was his first year, young kid. His dad's in the business, had such a strong work ethic. 6 years later, he's making 200 grand doing the same job, but he's worked his way up in the ladder. For the same company, he owns his own house and he has a rental unit. And he's still young. He's in his early 30s now. He's doing really well. He works hard, but he understood the value of that relationship. He started at the bottom, regular rate that they offered him, and then he proved himself. And here you go, 6 years later, he's making a lot of money doing what he loves doing, and he's providing for his family, and he's got a nest egg that he's growing. These kids of today, I've joked over and over, they want their age in their hourly rate. That's what they want, right? Which I think is too high. I think you have to prove yourself first. And then also understand that if you work with this business, they'll work with you. And then you never know what a year from now is going to be like, and so on, 2 years from now. And then all of a sudden, 6 years from now, where you're going to be at.
So to that point, you have a lot of the younger generation complaining how they can't buy a home. And their parents' generation could afford to do that. Now, I understand that things are different now than they were before, but one thing that I just sort of put together as you were speaking is that the generation above me, like my parents' generation, they usually would work for an employer for a long period of time.
Yeah.
So is that correlated to being able to afford a home? I don't know, but that's just one thing that I just realized now.
I think it has something to do with
it. If you're more loyal to an employer over, and you develop your skills and your value to that employer, you help grow that business, you will be rewarded. But now you have people that are bouncing around for, like you said earlier, for $1 or $2 an hour extra.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that if you do that, at some point you're going to be capped. Maybe you're capped at $30 an hour, $35 an hour. How are you going to make that $200,000 a year? You can't. The only way you can do that is being loyal to an employer and help grow the business. You don't have equity in the business, but you'll be compensated in terms of salary.
Yep. I think there is truth into that. And I think also what's really valuable is someone sticking with a company when they're having a downturn, when that company is struggling, when they're having a hard time getting those leads coming in. If they start to understand that they want to be a part of this team, there's value in there. And back to that concrete company, no employee, there's probably 23 or 24 employees there. No employee in that company is making less than 100 grand. These aren't site supers. These are concrete people that are making, nobody is making less than 100 grand in that company. So it's like they've positioned their business a certain way and they attract a certain kind of person and they want longevity. 100% they want longevity. They want people to understand that this is a career now. This is what you're thinking about. And we want to see you thrive and have an end game. Like you said earlier in the show, how you're thinking way ahead. They want these same employees, these tradespeople, young ones, to understand that 30 years from now, this is what you could potentially be making. This is what you could potentially have achieved over those years, right? Those decades at that point. Versus the generation of today is like, I'm going to have to leave and go get another job for $2 more, right?
Yeah, like our site manager, site super, Jawal, has been with us for 3 years. His three-year anniversary just came up. And I told him, I'm like, I want to work with you for the rest of our careers. I want to work with you when your kids have kids. That's the type of long-term thinking that I have.
You're talking about Joel from Laneway?
No.
Oh, different Joel. Okay. Yeah. All right. I thought it was Joel. Can't be that many Joels in the city.
There's not that many.
No, it can't be. All right, let me do the 12 questions here, Kyle. 2x2 Construction, 647-425-0292. You can find him all over Instagram on that same handle and his website. What's your favorite construction word or phrase?
Fuck.
What's your least favorite tool?
Least favorite tool. Well, I hate the sound of a multi-tool.
Yeah, me too, especially a DeWalt one. Are you a DeWalt guy?
No, I'm Milwaukee.
You're a Milwaukee guy?
Every DeWalt tool that I have or have had in the past has always failed on me. Even a stapler. The stapler doesn't even have the staples come out.
You mean a regular stapler or just a spring?
A DeWalt stapler, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Stanley one or DeWalt one?
DeWalt. I just have bad luck with DeWalt.
I haven't had bad luck with DeWalt. I just find the multi-tool is just horrendously loud, more than other multi or oscillating tools. I'm not a fan of it. And I like that meme that's going around where it's like Dumb and Dumber and the most annoying sound in the world. And you cut to the DeWalt tool being used. It's like, that's exactly it. What do you miss from your childhood?
The freedom and no stress.
What construction sound do you love?
I like hammers, swinging, banging the nails, framing.
Production. Yeah. Favorite beverage?
Red Bull.
Red Bull, really?
Red Bull.
The energy?
I was trying to quit caffeine. I went from coffee to Red Bull.
Is that an upgrade or?
Well, I'm trying to stop Red Bull entirely, but it's tough.
What turns you on and off in construction?
Turns me on in construction is getting new jobs and new challenges. Turns me off in construction. I know last time I said change orders. I'm going to say that again as well.
Yeah, change I orders, pain in the ass. Do you thrive on the no's when you're trying to get leads and you're getting people saying, no, we just can't do it right now. We don't have the budget. We don't want to do it. Maybe next year.
Well, if you have the mindset that if every time someone tells you a no, your next yes is right around the corner, then sometimes you enjoy the no's.
There's going to be truth in there one day, one time. Favorite curse word?
Same as the first one, fuck.
What's your favorite vehicle, any mode of transportation?
Honestly, I'm just happy with my Honda Civic.
There's nothing wrong with it, man. They last forever. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt one day?
Maybe an engineer or just something regarding business. I love business, and I'm fortunate to have my two passions, business and construction, mixed into one.
What profession would you not like to do?
Drywall taping.
Yeah, it's not one of my favorites, man. I'm impressed with good quality, but it's not one of my favorites. Last question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at those pearly gates?
Welcome.
Kyle, man, it's good to see you. Thanks so much for making the time
and
catching us up and continue doing some good work, man. Seriously.
Thank you. And you as well, because your voice, it's a powerful voice in the industry.
Thanks.
And I tell people, you're like the Joe Rogan of construction.
Yeah, but without, yeah, no, I've heard that several times, and it's fun just talking to you guys. And like I said before on mic, I don't swing the hammer anymore. Maybe that'll happen one day, but we'll see. But it might be on my terms because I think I've had my fair share of good and bad in the industry, right? So I'm very respectful of people that are still doing really well in the industry, right? I'm just trying to pay attention to it, and then I share the information. Whether what you guys do with it, whatever you want with it, right?
Like, you're at 600 episodes right now, and I've probably listened to about half of them. Nice. Just the amount of knowledge that I've gained and soaked up, like, essentially for free.
Yeah.
Which is, it's crazy now. You can learn whatever you want for free.
Just take an hour and a half time, listen, and then also reach out to other people. That's what's been going on, which is really well, right?
Traffic. Sit in traffic instead of listening to music. Listen to a podcast. Listen to a book.
Music today sucks anyway, man. I'm only listening to the old school nowadays, but that's it. All right, Kyle. Thanks so much, man. We're out of here, Angelina.